Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sarah Williams Devereaux. Sarah Williams Devereaux is a transformative language artist, mixed media artist, and educator. She lives in Pittsburgh and has read her work at local venues, including Choice Cuts Reading Series, the new Yinzer Reading Series, Incredibly Thin, She Said, and the Hungry Sphinx Reading Series. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you, Jan?
Just great. It's exciting to have you here, and you're going to read some poems.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I hope everyone enjoys listening to the poems on the radio. So here we go. Some Other Lock. Every now and again, you are given a night in which you are reminded that you are given too much. All these things that you do not need. This hardwood floor, granite countertops, this breath in your lungs, and even your beating heart. It is too much. These new clean sheets on a fresh queen-size bed that's finally large enough for you and your man who carries only 1 pound of bull in his bag. The man who you're not sure you love, who you're not sure has the right key for you, but the one who opens some other lock to what you do not want to see but want desperately to change, and what he thankfully doesn't mention. Your too many folds of skin he touches softly in the morning. Your jokes, too fast and loud, he laughs louder and longer than you. When he takes your face in his warm hands and tells you he loves you, you wonder if he pities you. After the solstice, 1. The longest day gives way to a full green night, the year turning riper, a watermelon sweetness still good to the mouth. I walk down Potomac Avenue from my new apartment, night thick with the smell of ginkgo and the bakery's flowery aroma. I want to be like the bakers in this late night, pressing lovely sweet things into balls of dough that rise in darkness, ready for baking when the sun comes up. Boys set off firecrackers in the road, bursts of heat and light and color as fast as fireflies, sparks of green gold flashing like photo bulbs. I breathe in, breathe out, as I wait for the smoke to clear, the moon turning, turning, a single bright seed in the sky. My father saves things. My father wraps donuts and potato chips in napkins, plastic wrap, more napkins, then layers and layers of scotch tape. These hermetically sealed packages appear on my bed, shiny dark chocolates, dime bags of creamy salted cashews. My father saves things he never had, nibbles at them for weeks and months, saltwater taffy, Easy Rollins novels, stubs of candles and incense from his altar. He's just getting around to watching the Bruce Lee videos my mother bought him last year. He doesn't ask for anything on his birthday or Father's Day. This Christmas, I give him sweet oranges and fresh peanuts, like he had as a child in a good year. The day that comes. When the sun rises, a throbbing vein of light in the sky, there is the day that can't happen, the day that shouldn't happen, the day that would happen, the day that must happen. When the sun is hard and hot and ready, the day that isn't happening, the day that couldn't possibly be happening, that was, that has, that will. When the sun sharpens the edges of the world, the day we wish, the day we fear, the day we know, The day that comes, the day we know, the day that is.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sarah Williams Devereaux, reading her poems. Sarah, I want to talk to you about the sense of the other world that always seems to be in your poems. Maybe not in the poems, it seems to be underneath and around and through the poems. And when I listen to your work, it's like being transported somewhere, which is great. And I usually don't think about it, but because we're doing this interview, I was thinking, now is it your voice, which is so soothing, you know? And there's a lot of the sensual imagery, but no, I think it's, you know, there's something in the poetry that is that evokes this other world. Can you talk about that a little?
So what do you mean when you're transported to the other world? What do you see when you're in that other world?
Well, what do I see?
Yes, I'm curious to. I'm always curious to see what other folks find interesting in my work.
I don't think I see anything. It's more of a feeling. I feel like in your solstice poem, you had phrases like the full green night, you know, watermelon sweetness, and you ended on that image of the moon. So I think I'm in the poem with these images, but it's this sense of movement and sort of like not an undertow, but another universe happening at the same time. So it's not something I see. It's a feeling of being moved deeper and other in a good way.
I think that's the kind of feeling that I hope to generate from my poems. Depending on where I'm writing them, sometimes I will be on the bus, I'll be at home, and I'll see something that catches my eye, whether it's the shade of someone's hair or the way that the light reflects off of a building or anything like that. And it is this sort of this transportation to another place, the words underneath the words, and that's the kind of sensation that I'm trying to evoke. I was having a conversation with someone where they said that talking about music was incredibly difficult for them because there were almost no words to describe it. They were trying to get to the emotion underneath the notes, and I think that's what I try to do in my poems, is get to the emotion underneath the words or the experience or the look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you do very well. And as you know, there are many poets out there who try to do that and are not successful. So I wonder if you could talk about the writing of the poems and how do you make your word choices, or how do you create some kind of poetic landscape that transports us?
I usually try to keep my poems as raw as possible. The way that it usually comes out from my brain, and try to keep that on the page as much as possible. The word choice that I have, I'm always trying to, if I'm particularly having a problem with a poem, I will try to push it to another level, because there's, I guess I'm trying to just pull out the inner sensuality of all of these different objects, from the moon to the smell. And it's sometimes it's really easy. I think it's probably just about being very present in the moment of observing and writing. You mentioned the after the solstice poem, and that was coming after an experience I had of basically walking from the trolley to my apartment, and every night I'd pass through this lush forest of ginkgo trees and the bakery, and it was just it's very easy to find all this fodder for lushness in poetry when you're really able to be present for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I try to evoke that in my work, is by being present in the writing and saying, okay, now what does this actually look like? Is it aquamarine? Is it cobalt? Is it, you know, Prussian blue or whatever sort of color I'm trying to pick for my poems.
Okay. Could you read more poems?
Of course. This next one is called What Lies Inside. This is another one of those poems that came to me during the public transit system. Every poet must have a bus poem of some sort if they are living in an urban area. So this is called What Lies Inside. And I'm also interested in the way that neighborhoods and ideas clash or don't clash, intersect or not intersect. So that's what this is about. What Lies Inside. Red shirt, black afro puffs, glittering wheels. The children ride their bikes in the street. Across the way, rows of tomatoes, pole beans, lettuce and beets with their red leaves. The early September heat. Farm stand, Wednesday, 3 to 5 p.m. The kids ride in between traffic cycles, dart out to pedal between the SUVs and sedans, coming through Homewood to Point Breeze. Under the MLK Junior Busway Bridge, they pedal high and fast up off the seat, down the hill, up past the chicken and fish takeout, the community mural, Egyptians and Nubians and revolutionaries cast in the faces of neighbors, past the farm share, tomatoes curling and splitting in the heat, past White Memorial Chapel, streets lined with cars from another neighborhood, mourners in their flowered dresses and cool summer suits. A man outside waters the lawn, graying with the heat. On the porch, a baby crawls inside the home. She does not realize that there is a body inside and crawls toward it anyway. These things, growing, shifting, moving from neighborhood to neighborhood, the sun covering them all. The kids don't stop, the cars pass through. How often do we know what lies inside, but go in anyway? These things, separated by only a few feet of covered earth. This next one is called Invocation, 1839 Wiley Avenue. And as anyone who is an August Wilson fan knows, that is the house of Aunt Esther, one of the most amazing characters ever in the history of literature. Invocation, 1839 Wiley Avenue. All there is, all that remains, an empty house in the sky, invisible, an empty field of peace and stones and grass and spirits. Light, the churches and hospitals in the distance, an old stone wall with moss and will-o'-wisps. This love, this woman and man with the children, this spirit, this father, the son, the smell, the sweet smell of dandelions and wet earth ready for plowing, the rain. The woman walking down the street with her son. Don't you like school? Don't you want to be smart? Her boy in a red parka tottering down the street. Now, how many dollars would you have if you took one from 200? The sunlight over the hills, coming through golden and bright. The houses in the distance, the folds of the hills where the sky and earth meet, the long streets with boys on them. Come, my family, from all four corners of the earth. I conjure you with sage and salt water and your names. Clarence, Norma, John, Minerva. Tell me your name so I can know. Love is the only identity in this place of remembering. Love like the flesh of a juicy, tart apple. Delicious, delicious, colorful life. Sinking in my teeth. I also have a background in visual arts, and this is coming off of that experience that I had in some of my first college drawing classes. It's called life drawing. When Picasso was in love, all cubism fell away. No sharp, jutting, all-purpose orifices, no jagged, broken pieces of women rearranged into the shape of their latest argument. His paintings morphed into open O's, ellipses of breasts, globes for eyes, the soft, curious circumference of lips. The first man I saw naked was our figure-drawing model in college. For 3 days he wore underwear. I had to stop and stare and watch him for a moment. For your birthday, I started painting again. 7 years after college, I studied your lines and face for a week straight before starting. Erase, draw, stare, read, stare at the wall, stare at you. The classical art directive, pre-photography. Draw what you see with your eyes. This strange organ hanging, flopping about. How did he go about his day with it there, outside, protected only by flimsy jeans and boxer shorts, without it getting hit all the time? The modern art directive, post-photography. Draw what you see with your soul. The human body is the most difficult subject to draw, because there are no straight lines, only curves that, if rendered incorrectly, make the figure a little old, a little strange. We are all drawn incorrectly sometimes. A twisted artery here, a divot in the leg that keeps us from walking where we need to go. My genitals were tucked inside of me, and even when they grew, they were not flesh uncontrollable, not like an arm or a leg that could be moved in case of danger, not his softness there. After 4 years of drawing class, it became just another body part.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sarah Williams Devereaux, reading her poems. It seems to me that one thing that you're saying, you're enacting in your poems, is that the artist needs to pay a very different kind of attention to the world. And you started saying that before, but in the poem about the model, that is really in the poem about, you know, stopping and watching, stopping and looking. How much of that is part of your process as a writer?
It's very much in my process as a writer. One of the things that I try to do, as I mentioned before, is keep everything raw when it comes off of the page. But one of the things that I want to do is be very aware when I'm writing my poems and listen to what the poems have to say. One of the experiences that I had recently was going to the Transformative Language Arts Conference that is held every year in Goddard College in Vermont, and it focuses on people who are using the written word, the sung word, and the spoken word in order to enact personal transformation. And that's one of the things that I really believe in my work, is that the word and how you respond to it and how it responds to you can really serve as a force for personal change, societal change. So that's one of the things that I try to have in my work, is this sense of starting, stopping, listening, experimenting, because that's where the growth can happen in the poem, as a poet, with the people that you're working with in your community.
Mm-hmm. You also said that before you began reading this time that you were interested in neighborhoods, the clashing of ideas, the intersection of neighborhoods, or where they don't intersect. And can you talk a little bit about that in relation to what you're doing in your poems and in relation to trying to, sounds like you're trying to make change with your poems. Is that accurate?
I think that's definitely accurate. One of the things that I keep going back to this idea of listening, and I think that there's, in today's society, there's not enough listening to the self. You know, we have all of these different things that we can use, whether it's the iPod or the radio or the TV or the HDTV or all of these other things that we can use to basically ignore ourselves. And ignore each other and ignore our communities. And so part of it is also trying to listen to your own story and truly listen to the stories of other people and try to capture that or try to empower people to capture it for themselves. So that's one of the things that I try to do in my writing, is not only make sure that I'm listening to myself, but also to try to accurately represent the things that I see around me, but also to highlight things like in the What Lies Inside poem. You know, it's Pittsburgh is a very segregated city, and it's not just geography. And there have been times when I've gone from one block to another, and the landscape, the demographics, the economic situation changes drastically. And I think as someone who sees that and writes about the world around her, I feel like I have a duty to try to at least highlight that in my poems.
Thanks. Could you read more, please?
Of course. This next one is called Snack Time. This is a true story. I saw this happening on the bus. Again, buses are such wonderful instruments, and they enable people to move around the city. So this is called Snack Time. I want the mouth that will eat a peanut butter sandwich cookie with care, that will nibble the ridged edge, peel the thin cream away with a thick tongue and lips that could open a stubborn pickle jar. The hands that can finger the crackers apart, turn and twist them, two perfect eyes considering the sticky, smooth concoction like Robert Indiana ate his mushroom for Andy Warhol, pushing each cracker out of its plastic skin, chewing slowly, licking away the flaky yellow crust, holding each golden circle between red lips, biting with sharp teeth and chewing it soft, pulling the thin wafer further and further, licking away the crumbs and salt from his thumb, and finally throwing into his mouth the whole savory snack. The one thing you come back to after all others have gone. In heaven, the one thing you choose for the rest of your life. You are given the choice of a key. Millions hang from small wooden pegs. Brass, silver, gold. Choose only one that fits in your hands. The shape worn away. It will not be new. It will be worn down and smooth just by your hands. It will be your first and best destiny. It is the only thing that matters. All else burns away like silver poured into wax molds, dirt burned out of steel until it is a single white flame. All else falls away. Throw the stones and seeds and soil up into the wind, and the seeds will remain. Poppies, marigolds, the only road you will ever feel comfortable walking on. The cobblestones worn by your feet and your feet alone. This next one is called Waiting. The past year has been a little bit, traumatic for a number of friends and family. There's been a lot of death and sickness in the air, and this is an older poem that I pulled out, but it seems to be appropriate for some of the current vibe of friends and family lately. Waiting. Face pinched pale, she clutches a plastic basin as if it were his hand. Her hands, worn thin, soft as his shirts she used to wash. He feeds her Boost, not tropical, not strawberry, only chocolate. Too warm, she says, after every mouthful. Ice, more ice, another swallow, then no more for tonight. He paces wide steps, pants hang loose on his hips, shirt coming undone. He eats his one meal in the hospital cafeteria. Tired green beans, chicken teriyaki, roll with butter. At home, he washes her nightgown, peach with pink flowers. He hangs it in her bathroom, turning, drifting in the light he leaves on. This next one is called Considerations, and it has a number of different voices to it. So there'll be some pauses, stops, and starts. I looked into the face of a sister on the 71A Negley. Her eyes filled with wrinkles. I did not give her my seat because she did not look old enough for me to give myself to her. She was crumpled, but could still stand. I need a good job. How many people are going to read my application if I look like a threat? I got to look like the words I'm learning to write. Is being black a mantle to be thrown off and on at will? A pair of shoes, a henna tattoo? The free will astrologer says, with fitness, grooming, and an open heart, anyone can be wildly attractive. Revel in your freakishness. It's interesting how everyone is invoking the name of August Wilson now that he is dead. Because we associate the true self with various limiting aspects, we superimpose such ideas as caste, color, and status upon it, just as we superimpose flavor, color, etc. on water. Shankara's Atmabodha, self-knowledge. On the back of the Port Authority bus seat, racism, why? Blood red, crap stinks. African, no name. Nigger, colored, Negro, black. Afro-American, African-American. Fill in with your future guess here.
It's the poetry of Sarah Williams Devereaux. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's great. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.